Psalm 121. It's family road trip season. My memory growing up of packing up, getting ready to go on a trip, tucked between sleeping bags and luggage, and pre-dawn, getting ready to go, and Dad would always lead us in a prayer. That's the first thing we'd do, and I don't think I do it just because my dad did it, but that's what we do when I remember. Have a prayer before we go on a trip for safety. You know, this is before, you know, we all had GPSs on our phones, so, you know, we could get lost. The prayer before the trip. I just started walking us through Psalm 120 through Psalm 134, and I don't plan on covering every single psalm, and I won't cover any other psalms but Psalm 121 today. But in this series, I'll be covering some of these psalms. And they are songs not so much from home, about the journey from home out, but for Israel, songs of the journey to home, back home. And that journey imagery we talked about last time was rooted in Israel's history and in their story from Egypt, going over to Jerusalem, going to the Promised Land, to the times when they're in exile and various places, but especially Babylon, and to the pilgrimages that they would make as there's Israelites, Jews scattered throughout the world, pilgrimages back for those three annual feast days. It looks like they would use these songs as songs about going home in the history and tradition of these psalms. And that imagery continued into Christian imagery as far as that journey home and our promised land and God's dwelling and the blessing of those who seek his dwelling. We sing plenty of songs. I'm sure there you can think of some plenty of songs with the same sentiments of pilgrim songs, that word pilgrim showing up in a lot of our songs. Journey, the road through the wilderness, across the Jordan to the promised land. Those kinds of images are rich in our psalms. Let's go ahead and read Psalm 121. And I'll just start with, verse 0 is the title there. A Song of Ascents. Verse 1, I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. I remember remembering some of the characteristic things about these psalms. Short, a lot of repetition. You can see that here in this psalm. Easy to learn and to sing as you went, perhaps. They're setting out on a journey, I think, is a fair picture here. The psalmist, the person, the voice of the psalmist here, is saying he's looking out to the hills, looking out to the horizon as you set out. And, you know, I get images of that kind of terrain and the hillsides, the desert hillsides that they're walking. Verse 3, he will not let your foot be moved. I've gone on some trails with my kids in Illinois. That's not too treacherous, I guess. But we're up in Minnesota. My brother takes us to a moderate, you know, trail, which moderate, when you take 6 and under kids, is extremely difficult and treacherous. And so and there are moments where you're just like, you know, my children trip on the sidewalk, even when there's not a bump in the sidewalk, and like, This drop here just doesn't seem like it's for kids. I get those kinds of images in your mind and the road that would be between Babylon or wherever they were back to Jerusalem and the real dangers that they would have faced. As the journey continues, it's not like this is not a day trip when they would make pilgrimages back. So verse 6, the sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. And take the most beautiful scene and then put yourself there, the most beautiful scene in nature, and then put yourself there in the middle of the night, and sometimes the most beautiful scene that you could just bask in and appreciate becomes frightening when you're there in the middle of the night, especially when it's a foreign place. But God would be with them, it keeps saying. God would keep them and protect them. He would be their help. And all that good news, to appreciate all that good news there about how God keeps and protects his people, how he's with his people, needs to be appreciated in the context of the real dangers that they faced in that kind of a trip. And of course, we're making the spiritual application for ourselves. There's real dangers. And to appreciate the comfort and reassurance of a psalm that says God is keeping you and guarding you, we have those verses that tell us the devil is out there hunting you, hunting people down like a roaring lion. Jesus says it's a narrow and difficult path that we can't go into our journey of life, journey of faith, as if it is going to be wide and easy. We're specifically told. Not just that it's narrow and only a few would go, but it's narrow and difficult, and so only a few would stay on that path. I'm going to use a couple of passages in Old Testament narrative sections, historical sections, to bring this out. Go to Ezra 8. If you would, Ezra chapter 8. This is a return from captivity period, and Ezra is making his trip back to organize temple worship, to bring riches from Babylon to, or I guess Persia, to enrich temple worship, enrich the temple and beautify it. So in chapter 8, verse 21, we're going to see him leading priests and others who are going to be going back to the promised land. Let's read chapter 8, verse 21, starting 21 through 35. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God, to seek from him a safe journey for ourselves, our children, and all our goods. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and implored our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. The next section is a little bit long, but there's a point I want us to get from it. Verse 24. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their kinsmen with them, and I weighed out to them the silver and gold and the vessels, the offering in the house of our God that the king and his counselors and his lords and all Israel there present had offered. I weighed out into their hand 650 talents of silver and silver vessels worth 200 talents and 100 talents of gold, 20 bowls of gold worth 1,000 derricks and 2 vessels of fine bright bronze as precious as gold. And I said to them, you are holy to the Lord and the vessels are holy. And the silver and the gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, and the God of your the God of your fathers. Guard them and keep them until you weigh them before the chief priests and the Levites and the heads of their of fathers' houses in Israel at Jerusalem, within the chambers of the house of the Lord. So the priests and Levites took over the weight of the silver and the gold and the vessels to bring them to Jerusalem, to the house of our God. Then we departed from the river Ahava, and on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes by the way. We came to Jerusalem, and there we remained 3 days. On the 4th day, within the house of our God, the silver and the gold and the vessels were weighed into the hands of Meremoth the priest, son of Uriah, and with him was Eleazar the son of Phinehas, and with them were the Levites, Jozabad the son of Jeshua, and Noadiah the son of Benoi. But the whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded. At that time, those who had come from captivity, the returned exiles, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and as a sin offering, 12 male goats. All this was a burnt offering to the Lord. They're on this trip, all the way back to Jerusalem, and look at all the stuff they've got with them. Who wouldn't want to raid this caravan? They're going to be easy picking, I would think, too. I mean, they're weighed down. They're not carrying checks or something. They're carrying, weighted down with wealth. They're a target. Don't know that it's written for this parallel, but sometimes I think we think, hey, because we're Christians, we get a free pass, and we're insulated, and Satan knows what's up, and he's not going to mess with us. But it's really the opposite, isn't it? That Satan, we become a target for him. That we have the riches and blessings of as children of God. Of course, those are from God and they belong to God. But Satan attempts to take us and to plunder us. We're targets. And amazingly, Ezra didn't ask for an escort. He could have. He didn't ask for an escort. Instead, he sought the Lord's protection, and the Lord heard their prayer and gave them safe passage. I didn't check how long the journey is, but it's a substantial journey with all those people and all those supplies. There's a temptation to put our security in other forms of protection. There was, of course, a special covenant with Israel, and we had to factor that in our application, that God would bless them as they sought to return. It was built into Deuteronomy. When you rebelled against me and I kicked you out of the land, that Deuteronomy 30, if you turn to me with your whole heart, I would bless you to be able to return. And so they've got that built into the covenant, and they could seek the Lord and God would give them a safe passage. But we have the same ultimate promise. Not a promised safe trip for vacation, but promised safe journey to home, to our eternal home. And so, are we content with the promise of God to be our protection? What if we add layers of protection over God's protection? What if we shore up walls He's already built? What does it say about our confidence in His protection? And those are questions for us to think about. Maybe it says we don't completely trust Him. When you look at Ezra, though, doesn't part of you think, what are you thinking? Don't be so foolish. You know, there's the story of maybe the help that God is giving you is the guard. You know, He sent you a boat, sent you a helicopter. You know the story about the guy sinking in the water. Well, you know, God's going to help me. God will save me. Isn't Ezra doing that? Doesn't it seem like Ezra's doing that? God is giving you help in the form of an imperial guard, you know, an escort. He doesn't take it. It doesn't say it would have been absolutely sinful if he had taken it. But it clearly isn't foolish for him not to take it. And so some more questions to think about, okay? The areas in which we apply things aren't always clear, definite things. And so let's think about this. Do we tell a young couple, you have no business marrying each other until you're bringing in $60,000 a year? I wasn't told that, just so you know. And if I didn't listen. I knew someone who was told that. Do we tell people, you need to finish school before you have kids? Was it foolish for my friend Dan Kane, and I don't know if some of you might know about him and Sonia over in Sierra Leone. I guess we would have heard about some of that from Rick's reports. Was it foolish for them to move over to Sierra Leone, Africa, and to have their baby over there, rather than to come back to the U.S. and modern American healthcare? Do we blame the victim when that same Dan Kane gets three third world type diseases all at once and nearly dies? Do not call foolish or reckless what may actually be God-glorifying faith and trust. Their hope and their security aren't in American infrastructure and healthcare, and they're there preaching the gospel, and it looks like they actually believe it too. I think we can see that clearly. You know, it's not foolish. Those things we're describing aren't foolish, because it's so clearly in service to the kingdom. And yet, we might tell others in our situations all the ways that they got to shore things up, to be responsible and to be wise. So, those are questions and things we need to think about and discern. Again, I put this clarification in there because sometimes I even when I clarify things don't always come out as clearly as I hope. I am not saying that every form of thoughtful precaution is sinful. But we do well to examine our motives and to consider whether we trust our precautions more than we trust God. So even as we avail ourselves of precautions as we're on this journey, we do not ground our hope in them. And I think we need to continually check ourselves for that. So they have this journey, we have this journey, but he looks to the Lord for help. He looks to the horizon, looks to the hills, and his help comes from the Lord. That's where his security is. That's what Ezra was doing, and that's what the people of God are taught to do. I want to read Psalm 121 again, because the short, and get it back into our minds as we look at this next point. God is our help. We look to God for our help, and God is God. Let's read it again, verse 121. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. If some of you know the song, I don't know the title of the song. We have an audio of it in our van. I lift up my eyes to the Lord. From where does my help come from? It's hard for me not to sing that part. There's a hymn that takes some of the language of this. And in that same song, it says, you are who you are, no matter where I am. And that's basically the point I want us to focus on here. God is God. And so, verse 2, he's the maker of heaven and earth. He is not your run-of-the-mill Canaanite deity. It's a weird thing to say, I guess, for us. But what, in the ancient context, they had all kinds of gods or beliefs in gods around them and the expectations that went with that we can forget about. And the tendency was to shrink God, to make him more like the other Canaanite gods or the other gods. Limited in having power over some aspect of nature and geographically located. It had to work that way. If everyone's got these gods and two gods are at war, they clearly can't both be omniscient and omnipotent, rather. And so they're all going to have to be more limited. You know, Jonah gives into this way of thinking. Go preach in Nineveh. And he goes the opposite way, as if to run away from God, Yahweh, the great I am. You can't do that, right? And Jonah knows that because in chapter 1, verse 9, when he's confronted by the sailors and they say, hey, who are you? Where are you from? And he says, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews. I worship the God of Israel, the Lord, and who made the sea and the land. The dry land, he says. I wonder if there's a little emphasis and longing for that when he says it. Like, yeah, I worship the God who's over the sea and land. And here I am trying to run away on the sea. He knows that, but he wasn't acting like that. And so, okay, we're not generally comparing our God to other Canaanite gods, but do we treat him that way? In Numbers 22, we see that kind of treatment of Yahweh. Numbers 22, as the Israelites are making their way in the wilderness, wandering toward the promised land. Chapter 22 is where Balaam is being hired by the king of, I'm going to mix up Moab, Balak. Balak needs to deal with Israel, and so he is going to find a way, some kind of incantation, some kind of curse to hinder Israel. And so he hires, I guess, a professional wizard, witch, someone who he expects to be able to do divination and to offer a curse. I don't know what his own self-description for Balaam was, but that's what Balak expects of Balaam, to be able to put a curse on Israel. Long, humorous story, but we're not going to cover all of it today. But in chapter 23, he's secured the help, he thinks, of Balaam. Balaam reassures him, I can only do what Yahweh lets me do. But Numbers 23, verse 7, here's how it turns out as he goes to speak what Balak wants to be a curse on Israel. Verse 7 of chapter 23. And Balaam took up his discourse and said, from Aram Balak has brought me, the king of Moab from the eastern mountains. Come curse Jacob for me. Come denounce Israel. How can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? And then in verses 22 and 23, another attempt, and there's multiple attempts. God brings them out of Egypt and is for them like the horns of the wild oxen. For there is no enchantment against Jacob, no divination against Israel. Now it shall be said of Jacob and Israel, what God has wrought. God is the one bringing them out of Egypt. God is the one blessing them. So how could he curse them? Balak, and as he's attempting to bring this curse on Israel, is going to treat God, Yahweh, like he might see other Canaanite gods. You know, maybe we just didn't get the right recipe, right? We didn't do it quite right, the right methodology to bring this curse on these people. We got to manipulate the gods in some way. And so if you look at verse 13 of chapter 23, Balak said to him, to Balaam, please come with me to another place from which you may see them. You shall see only a fraction of them and shall not see them all. Then curse them for me from there. Now, let's try it this way. In chapter 23, verse 27, and Balak said to Balaam, come now, I will take you to another place. Perhaps it will please God that you may curse them from there. So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, which overlooks the desert. It's not enough that Yahweh is bringing these people out of Egypt, and Yahweh has a plan, and Yahweh is leading them. He thinks, you know, maybe if we just get the right curse from the right angle, we can hinder them. Complete folly when you're talking about the creator of heaven and earth. Christians, though, can be tempted to treat God as if he's a regional deity. Is he God over the church, but not over your private life? Is he God when things are going well in a comfortable life, but not God through your trouble? Is he God when you are feeling pretty good about yourself and your faith, and then no longer God when you've fallen into sin? Is he God? Is he the I Am? And if so, he's infinite, he's eternal, he's all-powerful and all-knowing, and you can always seek him. God is God. And so he looks to the Lord. Let's go ahead and read Psalm 121 one more time. And just notice the emphasis on keep, especially in the second half of the psalm. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. The Psalms of Ascents, and this psalm in particular, echoes a blessing that God gave Israel regularly and through the priesthood. So I want to go back over to number 6, some of the vocabulary of this blessing that the priests would speak are showing up in those psalms. So number 6, and again, this is the book of Numbers. They're in the wilderness. They've set out on their journey. They've left Egypt, and they're preparing to be a people as marching, following God's marching orders into the promised land. So number 6, let's look at that blessing that God gives them in verse 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, 'Thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.' So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them." From other passages, this looks like a blessing given at the tabernacle or later the temple. It would have been a regular thing. The name of Yahweh. I haven't been saying it that way, but, you know, all caps, Lord is the name of God, Yahweh. Being put on the people and blessing them and keeping them. And that's the main word that keeps on showing up 6 times in the short psalm we have in Psalm 121. Keep. When a priest pronounced that blessing, okay, so you've maybe made a pilgrimage back to Jerusalem for some feast that a priest is pronouncing that blessing on the people. How long is it good for? And what's the range? If you get out of the temple court, you know, does it expire? Is it like your Wi-Fi or something? Like God's blessing is good while you're there? No, it goes with them. The blessing is on the people. God is promising to bless them and be with them. And so before Balak comes along and tries to curse Israel, God had been continually reiterating his blessing on them, and no curse was going to stop that. As you know, the famous Christian rap artist has put it, Show Baraka, "You will not stop the Exodus when the Lord is blessing us." You can remember that now. The vocabulary then in this blessing, y'all can look it up later. Now you really want to. The vocabulary in this blessing is in those psalms then. And I don't know, it may be intentional that God is reiterating this blessing they would have known and weaving it through some of those psalms that they would sing on a journey to Jerusalem. And the significance of that is that the songs are just bringing the priestly temple blessing that they would have associated with that place and those events and saying, no, but it's with you. It's with you wherever you go. That's the point of God's blessing. And so the point for us is that these psalms and the hymns that we sing that echo the same ideas of the pilgrim journey, they can remind us that the blessing of God is present with us throughout our sojourning, not just in those moments and those places where we feel like God is close, but that God promises to be with us as we walk in faith toward him. So, the emphasis there on the language of keep, sometimes it's biblical terminology that you might start to realize that it means something a little different than what you usually mean by it. But keep, guard, protect, some translations even put it that way. That's really what is being talked about here, guarding and protecting us, which makes sense of that journey. He's guarding and protecting us. And so, the beginning of verse 8, the Lord will keep your going out and your coming in. I should note, it's in verse 3, verse 4, verse 5, verse 7, and verse 8. So 6 times between those verses, keep. God is keeping us. the priests and Ezra, as they were making their journey, were told to keep and guard the treasures, but really we're being told that it's God who is doing the keeping and guarding. And so there in verse 8, he guards our going in and coming out. When I read that, I thought, that seems like an idiom that we don't use, but it's in the Bible. I know it's in the Bible. He looked it up, and it's basically just, yeah, it's all your goings on. It's your life. It's thoroughly, day to day. God keeps us continually. And of course, he does this, as we should always do with scriptures, and he does this through Christ, seeing how it connects to Christ on our journey and our pilgrimage. He's with us. And we know he's with us because he is the pilgrim par excellence, right? He left glory to be a poor man. He went into the wilderness. He went where Israel had gone. Into the wilderness, tested. Israel failed, right? Again and again, they failed. But Jesus is the pilgrim who succeeds in the wilderness, who stays steadfast and faithful to his Father, even in severe temptations. He was faithful, then where we've been faithless. We've fallen short on our sojourn. We've gotten distracted. We've been on the wide path, but Jesus stayed on the narrow way all the way. He had the journey toward Jerusalem that final time, not to just celebrate the Passover, but be our Passover for us. And he went to the cross and was raised. He made that journey through death. And so we know that he is with us and he's able to bring us through. And so in verse 8, it doesn't just say he's with you from the day to day, you're going out and you're coming in, but from this time forth and forevermore. And that kind of language, when you see that scripture, you know it's so big, it's so great, it doesn't fit a narrow application. You know, this isn't just for Israel's pilgrimages back to the Promised Land. This isn't just for you in your lifetime. This is forevermore. That God will keep you eternally. One more passage, if you would, turn over to 1 Peter. We'll start chapter 1, verses 1 through 9. The whole book uses exile, sojourner imagery. 1 Peter 1, notice as we read verses 1 through 9, notice the keeping and guarding language as well, and the exile language. As we look at this, the fact that God guards us for eternity. Verse 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father in the sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ, and for sprinkling with his blood, may grace and peace be multiplied to you. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. He guards us, he keeps us. And like Ezra, who asked God to guard him and protect him, carrying all that wealth to go bring it to beautify the temple and offer sacrifices, they got there and they did exactly that. So we trust our God to bring us through, and we praise him now, and we will offer ourselves in the end. So through the dangerous journey, look to God for help. And remember that he is God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, and he is the one who keeps and guards us.